So good afternoon, everybody. Today's insight session comes from the SPC to give you an update on two topics. The first one that I'll talk to is about the superannuation reforms, particularly the actuarial issues associated with them, stemming from the changes announced in the last year's budget. And Saffron will talk about payroll tax, the recent payroll tax ruling, and how that affects DB contributions. I'm reminded that this is a webinar today, so when you want to ask questions, you need to have a microphone so that the people on the webinar can hear it, and Jess will be running around with them, so please wait for the microphone when you ask questions. But very happy to take questions, both Saffron and I, throughout or at the end of our respective sessions. Okay, so some of the topics that I'll be speaking about, a large number of slides that I'll try to get through in the next 20, 25 minutes, particularly focusing on the first four around DB issues, pensions, TBCs that we'll talk about, not to be confirmed, transfer balance caps and issues associated with them, and a few of the other things that stem from last year's budget. And I'll mention a couple of other things towards the end that I won't necessarily go through because they'll probably be covered in other sessions. Okay, so the transfer balance cap. As you'll all know, I'm sure, in the May budget last year, the government announced that there would be a cap on the amount that a retiree could hold that qualified for exemption from tax on investment income. This is referred to as the transfer balance cap. Initially, it's to be set at $1.6 million. It's subject to indexation. That indexation is at CPI, not AWOT, as we used to in most circumstances. Once a person enters their retirement phase, and that's, I guess, a sort of a new term, retirement phase rather than the accumulation phase, they will have their own transfer balance account, which effectively tracks their transfer balance, and that can be measured against the general transfer balance cap of $1.6 million or whatever it indexes to. Your own transfer balance cap gets set up as soon as you enter the retirement phase, so that means for anybody currently retired, it'll be set up at 1 July, or when someone reaches the retirement phase, it'll be established at that point. And it'll be subject to, some credits and debits as things occur. The main, credit is the initial amount that will go into it. How the value of the interest that defines the cap, that defines your retirement amount changes with investment returns alike does not influence your transfer balance account. Really, the main thing that will influence your transfer balance account will be once you've set it up, if you have a commutation and therefore you have a debit against it. The thing is that the excess must be removed. Your excess over your transfer balance cap must be removed. Now, what we're going to focus, of course, on today a fair bit is that there is an exemption from that requirement for what's referred to as a capped DB income stream. So a defined benefit lifetime pension or some other types that I'll talk about in a second. So what's a capped DB income stream? If you've had the joy of reading CIS Regulation 1.06, you'll find that it goes for some 20 pages, I'm sure, of different types of definition of what's a pension. But for the purpose of this legislation, it's at the moment only lifetime DB pensions that satisfy the definition of a pension under CIS Regulation 1.06 bracket 2. And that applies to any pension under that regulation, whether it was already in existence or whether it commences in the future, as long as it's under rules that were in place in 2007 when a lot of the changes to this legislation was made around better super or stronger super. There are some other types of pensions or annuities that could qualify as capped DB income streams, but that's only those types of pensions and annuities that were in existence on 30 June this year. And they're referring to things like market-linked pensions or life expectancy pensions. So they're going to be grandfathered. But going forward, in terms of a new pension, it'll only be one that is a lifetime pension that we're used to seeing, I guess, typically in corporate or private sector DB arrangements. Of course, unfunded government arrangements have lifetime pensions as well. As it stands, that was quite a concern, and quite a concern to the SPC, because the definition of a pension under 106 bracket 2 is really narrow. You know, it's got to be a lifetime pension. If you had even the remotest ability that you could commute that pension, then it didn't satisfy the requirements of 106.2. Whether that was on a discretion that the member could exercise, or whether indeed just a discretion that only the trustee could exercise, even if you didn't have an example of, or a previous case of the trustee exercising it, if there was the potential for a lifetime pension to be commuted, then it falls foul of the definition of 106.2. There's also doubts about children's pensions. If you have the ability to vary those pensions based on the number of dependent children, that could also fall foul of 106.2. So as the legislation became law, as it exists at the moment, that's a really narrow definition. So there was quite a concern that plenty of particularly private sector, corporate, DB type pensions that I'm sure most of you are familiar with would not be classified as a capped DB income stream. And that could lead to the situation where if their transfer balance account, if the value of that lifetime pension was greater than their transfer balance cap, people could be forced to commute a lifetime pension. So effectively lose an accrued right and have to have a lifetime pension with its investment protection, with its longevity protection, converted to a lump sum. So that concern was raised with Treasury. The outcome of that was that on the Thursday before Easter, a draft regulation was published that effectively extended the definition of a capped DB income stream. And the wording in that regulation pretty much mirrors the wording that is in another regulation, 106.9a(b)(4). I didn't quote the little letters and the Roman numerals there, but I'm sure you'd be familiar with that pension if you're involved with these kind of things. It basically took the wording of that and put it in a regulation. And that basically says that a capped DB income stream is a pension like the 106A version, the 106.2 version I mentioned before. And indeed, the only reason that it doesn't satisfy the definition of 106.2 is because it allows commutations or variations due to the number of dependents. So it basically covered our typical kind of DB lifetime pensions that we're probably most familiar with. So if that regulation then becomes law, and that isn't law at the moment, it's only a draft regulation, it's an exposure draft, subject to comment, I think by next week. If it does become law, then we think, you know, largely most DB lifetime pensions will expected to be covered as a capped DB income stream. So the question that we have at the bottom of that slide is for you to think about your clients, and if you think you have a defined benefit lifetime pension that isn't a capped DB income stream because it's not captured by this expanded definition, we'd be interested to know, because we should be considering that in whether we make a submission on this draft, exposure draft regulation. I might even look around and see if anybody can think of any at this particular point in time. Okay. Thank you. So we've now got potentially got an expanded definition of lifetime pensions that are covered as capped DB income streams. What does that mean in terms of your transfer balance cap treatment? There's a single factor used to value capped DB income streams for transfer balance purposes. That single value is 16. That applies regardless of anything, age, any other things you would think of might be relevant for setting a commutation factor. So simply, the value of that of your pension for transfer balance cap purposes is 16 times the value of the pension that first applies either after 1 July, if you're already retired by 1 July, or on the first time you turn into a pensioner. Why that was a little bit clumsily said, I'm trying to say is that it's not exactly just, if you're on 100 grand a year, it's 100 grand. You actually, if you're paid fortnightly, you work out what it is for that fortnight and multiply it by, divide it by 14 and multiply it by 365. You might get a slightly different number. The issue with capped DB income streams is that regardless of the value that you get when you multiply your annual pension by 16, so even if it's over 1.6 million, you don't have to commute that excess. What happens is that there is a different tax treatment to these capped DB income streams that says that over age 60, the first 100,000 is tax-free, and of the balance, you have to declare 50% as assessable income. So you will potentially pay tax. If you're actually under age 60, then it's the current rules that apply, which, as you probably know, is your pension is taxed at your marginal rates unless a 15% rebate. The issue here is that if people have both lifetime pensions and account-based pensions, that if they are over the cap, they're going to have to adjust their account-based pension. So say my pension is 100 grand a year, okay, and I've got an account-based pension of any number really, 500,000 in a great situation. 100K times 60 is 1.6 million. Any account-based pension that I have is over the cap. And I will have to convert that back into a accumulation phase or into a superannuation account, basically, and it'll be subject to the normal 15% tax. So really, I've got a mixture of an account-based pension and a lifetime pension. The only part that I can leave in an account-based pension is basically the transfer balance cap, 1.6 million, less the value of my DB income stream. And obviously it can't go negative, so if my DB income stream is worth more than 1.6 million, it's deemed to be 1.6 million because it's capped and protected, but it leaves me no scope for an account-based pension. So how will this work in practice? Okay, the first step is that the ATO will send out a determination that outlines its default position. Okay, if it thinks you've just retired, it's been advised by your fund, it thinks your benefit's over the TB transfer balance cap, it will send you a determination saying you're over the cap, you're going to have to take some money out, and you need to respond within 60 days. And why they give you that option is because there may be some late developments, you may have actually commuted some of your pension or whatever. But assuming, or you may have account-based pensions in two different accounts, and it's going to take some money out of one and you'd rather it take it out of the other. So you have a chance to influence what's happening. But after that 60 days, you actually get an authority, a commutation authority. That commutation authority is issued to the fund. The fund must comply with it. The fund must make reasonable efforts to let you know that it's received this authority and what's going to happen. But ultimately, the fund must follow this commutation authority. It will work out what needs to be commuted. Now that we actually have pensions that are able to be commuted, it is, I guess, technically possible that you could commute that pension or part of that pension on receiving that authority and not, I guess, refusing to commute it and staying and having it treated as a capped DB income stream. And so we'll talk a bit more about that option in a second, because that raises a whole range of actuarial issues. But assuming that you wish to have all of your lifetime pension not commuted, if the fund gets an authority that says it's supposed to commute part of your pension, it can refuse that authority if it's refusing it only in the circumstances of the fact that we're talking about a capped DB income stream, or you're dead. It's a different set of rules. So the fund gets this authority, okay? It has to decide whether it's going to commute or not. On the assumption that it doesn't commute, it then tells the ATO that it's not commuting because it's a capped DB income stream, and lets you know at the same time, and then you're subject to the rules as a, for the taxation of that, under those commensurate tax treatment rules of first 100K, if you're over age 60, tax-free, and the balance, you declare 50% as assessable income. Okay, so where might get a bit tricky? I mean, I did mention before that now, voluntarily, if you are able to commute your lifetime pension, should you wish to do so, that could raise a whole range of complex issues, particularly if the fund has not been in the habit or indeed allowed commutations to take place in the past. It will raise issues like, if you haven't had to do these in the past, what rules should you apply to commutation? What basis should you determine? Could you use to determine the commutation factors for actually commuting this pension? Should you take a different approach for new commutations compared to the past, where you may not have done them very often? Should you take the same approach to commuting pensions, the portion of a pension over 100 grand compared to under 100 grand? You might say, why would I even think of that? Well, you could perhaps make an argument with tax only applying over 100 grand. There's perhaps more chance of selection if someone wanted to commute the portion over 100 compared to the portion under 100. Should you ask for health evidence? That's a normal question you would ask if you're thinking about a voluntary commutation. Is it because a person has, you know, health challenges that they now wish to commute? All of these would have implications for your funding. Allowing commutations. Many of these questions, I should say, by the way, they're really trustees issues more than actuarial issues, but the trustees generally look to the actuary for advice or for some input. If you start allowing commutations, then there's a potential for complaints about the level of the commutation factors that you're using. There are tax implications that we won't go into or get involved with, because that's tax advice that we don't give. You need to consider the communications that you give to pensioners, how you actually action those commutations, and indeed whether you should be encouraging your pensioners to take financial advice on what would be a very potentially complex decision, basically to give up a portion of a pension that is longevity and investment risk protection for something that might have some slightly better tax benefits. What's an example of this? Why might you even consider this? Say your pension was 100 grand a year, but say you were, you know, getting relatively old, sort of say 75 or so. Having your pension determined at a valuation factor of 16 puts a higher value on it for transfer balance cap purposes probably than it really is. So on my 100 grand a year example, and I'm 75, that gets valued at 1.6 million. The example I sort of alluded to before, and I've got say 500,000 in an account-based pension, I would have to transfer all of that account-based pension into a superannuation or an accumulation phase investment tax at 15%. But what if my trustee was willing to commute my 100 grand and came up with a valuation, given that I'm 75, of, just for hypothetical numbers, say 10. So that 100 grand a year is valued by the trustee at 10. They'd give me $1 million for that. So if I commuted my pension, I'd have $1 million from the commutation, then my 500,000 from my account-based pension, 1.5 million, I'm under 1.6. So I'd have all of my benefit in an investment that got tax-free investment income. But of course, I've given up something potentially very valuable in having a portion of my benefit subject to protection from investment risk and from longevity risk. So I could see these situations potentially arising, potentially being considered by financial advisors, potentially being raised with trustees, trustees potentially coming to ask you for what you think they should do. So no answers, but just making you aware that these situations, you know, we could envisage them arising. Okay. There has been some discussion too about this issue of expanding the definition of capped DBM income streams. This is like, is it actually, I guess, a good idea compared to not? I guess harking back to that example I had before, and it all has to do with the fact that the valuation factor is a fixed single number of 16. There are no doubt pros and cons, but I think on balance, we felt that it is better for the definition of capped DB income stream to be expanded, because the worst outcome would be having a situation where pensioners are forced to commute a lifetime pension. Now, albeit that there are some issues around whether this is a fair valuation using a single factor of 16 and the like, but I think that swayed our thinking to think that having an expanded definition of a capped DB income stream is a good thing. So I guess that's saying we wouldn't be challenging this draft regulation that came out. And this is just summarising some of the things that we thought about in coming to that into that view, which I just might accelerate a bit because I'm just conscious of time. And there's a couple of other points I just wanted to cover about these changes. Another one is that transfer balance cap is used for other purposes, not just for assessing when people get to retirement phase and what they can keep within the I guess, tax-free investment environment. So the total super balance is used for assessing whether you can make catch-up contributions and whether you can bring forward your non-concessional contribution amounts. So what this means is that you're possibly aware that there are some extra rules that are being introduced from these budget changes surrounding in relation to the catch-up contributions. I think starting from 2018-19, the concessional contribution cap's coming down to 25 grand this year. If your total super balance is under 500,000, then in future years, if you haven't used up all of your concessional contribution in the immediately preceding years, you can make some catch-up contributions, so i.e. more than 25k to catch up. So I'm just mentioning it because I'm saying that this transfer balance cap is used for more than just purposes of determining how your benefits are taxed or what you may keep in a retirement phase. For non-concessional contributions, that limit is now going to be 100,000 a year. Just like there is at the moment, there are bring forward rules where you could put in, say, up to the next 3 years contributions in 1 year or 2 years contributions in 1 year. That will still also apply, but only if your transfer balance cap is under, for a 3 year bring forward, under 1.4 million. So you're putting in 100K for the next 3 years and putting it in 1 year. Or if your transfer balance cap is between 1.4 million and 1.5 million, you could put in 2 years, 200K. If it's between 1.5 and 1.6, 1 year, 100K. But if it's over 1.6, you can't make any more non-concessional contributions. Okay, another byproduct of these new changes is that, as just mentioned, if you're over 1.6 million, you're not allowed to put in any more non-concessional contributions. What if your benefit design requires the member to put in a fixed contribution after tax, and they've already accumulated a benefit towards their retirement that's worth more than 1.6? The current rules don't make any exemptions for defined benefit arrangements under this scenario. And they basically say that you have to refund, you, the trustee, have to refund the excess non-concessional contributions. So that's a bit of a hassle if you've got a benefit design, like I just mentioned, with a fixed requirement for a member contribution. Because if you don't, those contributions are going to be taxed at 47%. The main, I guess, potential solution we can see to that is that you do refund those contributions and set up some sort of debt account, as we're used to setting up in the past for various reasons, being a family law or, if you go back far enough, surcharge. Now, whether that's going to be an issue or not, of course, it depends upon your benefit design, and I'm talking about after-tax contributions, and whether that's a requirement that, that your member make contributions in that fashion. A lot of members, if they've accumulated 1.6 million, are probably making contributions on a salary sacrifice basis, so they won't be affected by that. Other thing, another byproduct, is that after-tax contributions will be entitled to a tax deduction from 1 July 2017. Now, again, with that same sort of design I was just mentioning, where you have a fixed after-tax member contribution that's contributing, you know, funding part of that defined benefit, those contributions now could generate a tax deduction. And if they do, then they will be taxable. The legislation allows three options for DB funds. Effectively allow that to occur, and then you'll have issues to address about taxing those after-tax contributions, and where you get the funding for that from, or not allowing those contributions, personal contributions, to be subject to a tax deduction, or not allowing deductions for any personal contributions to defined benefit interest, so just quarantining it to the situation I just alluded to. We can see that there will be a number of administrative challenges in allowing a tax deduction for after-tax member contributions that are funding a portion of a defined benefit interest, in terms of, well, if they are subject to tax, suddenly there's 15% of the contribution gone. Where do you get that from? Do you have to go after the member to get it? Does the employer fund it? Which is the ultimate thing if you don't get it from the member. How would you go about getting it from the member? You don't know about this until well after the event. So a lot of challenges, and I think there's a from just various discussions that I've had, I guess a reluctance potentially to allow personal contributions to generate a tax deduction. So this is still being considered, but we haven't got much time because this starts from 1 July and an election has to be made if you're going to not allow a deduction for personal contributions. And that election has to be in a form that we don't know yet because we haven't seen anything yet from the tax office. So you'll need to consider this with your clients, and your clients will need to take a view on it before 30 June this year. Ray. Press it up, Ray.
Ray Murray. Yep. Brad, you and I were discussing this before you started.
Yeah.
My understanding is that that election is at a whole of fund level. So anybody who's running multi-employer funds, like, or multi-master trust or industry funds where there's more than one DB plan, I'm very interested in knowing whether the Institute's going to push to have that done at a plan by plan, which is obviously much more flexible and much better. Or conversely, I'm interested in you finding out from the room how many people have thought about this and are actually going to make the whole of fund election where they've got more than one plan that it might apply to?
Thanks, Ray. That's a really practical question. I hadn't thought of until you mentioned it before. But anybody associated with a multi-employer fund, and have you addressed this issue, whether you're going to be able to? Well, it seems that the way the law was written, that you can't address it at a sub-fund level. It has to be addressed at a whole fund level. So you make one decision that applies to all of your sub-funds. Ray, as usual, you're a trendsetter, I can ask, naturally I'll ask what happened for my feedback from my colleagues that did this in Melbourne, and that we'll table it at the SPC to table that question back with Treasury in our submission. But it's a practical, very practical question because it's perhaps really obvious that it should be asked because of the large number of DB sub-funds that now exist through various multi-employer arrangements. Okay. Thanks, Ray. So I'm pretty much well over my time, so I'm just going to mention that we had another couple of slides mentioning that there were various changes to tax certificates. In fact, there was the government had proposed to remove the requirement for actuarial certificates in relation to unsegregated assets with only related to account-based pensions. The SMS industry was quite against that, and the government actually agreed and withdrew the proposal because they saw value in having, actuarial certificates adding integrity to the process. And as we mentioned, actually, I'll cover this on the next slide too. You're very much probably aware that the tax on investment income for transition to retirement pensions, the tax exemption, will be removed for those people who are not actually yet in the retirement phase. I'm not aware of any DB TTR pensions, but obviously there would be an issue there because you would be paying more tax on your investment income, so how would you fund that? But it does cause a number of practical issues in what you do for your TTR pensions, particularly if they have slightly different investment options to your full account-based pensions, and how do you address the fact that they will now be taxed? You need new crediting rates, new unit prices? Do you need to, change how the asset allocations for them work? There is some relief referred to in the legislation that this will mean that for segregated portfolios, there's a need to rearrange the asset portfolio, the assets to comply with this, and that may take some little time. So some sort of proportionate or some improvised method for doing that, complying with legislation, will be permitted in the first little while. And we've also seen recently that there are draft regulations about the innovative retirement income streams. Other people in the institute are looking at that, but we're just making you aware that this is probably a topic for a future session and that we're aware of it. Obviously, what will need to happen once these exist, the definition of pensions and how they're treated for being, whether they're capped or not capped, will need to be taken into account, but I'm sure that will depend upon the particular design and the characteristics of those income streams. So that covers this first section. Any questions? Okay, so if not, I'll hand over to Saffron now to cover the payroll tax section.
Hi all. So today's second part of the session will be regarding payroll tax and DB contributions. And it's just a bit of an update to raise some additional points that were put into discussion a number of years ago. So we're actually going to seek members' feedback to update the discussion note and see if you've got any other questions or comments regarding this particular topic. So the background is that payroll tax legislation in various states and territories includes superannuation contributions as part of the definition of wages. So that obviously has impact on the tax that the employer is paying because it's part of their payroll tax. And this has only been incorporated into the definition of wages different dates for different states. So for Victoria, for example, it's from 1 July 1997. for New South Wales 1 July 1996. So prior to that date, there was no inclusion of superannuation contributions in the definition of wages. So there's a big change in tax, and you know, payroll tax can be up to 5 or 6%. The contributions that relate to relevant service before those particular dates when this definition changed are actually exempt from paying payroll tax. But it needs to be evidenced to the satisfaction of the commissioner. And an actuarial certificate is one way of providing evidence, justification for this, and in the absence of that, any other proof of the fact. There have been a number of cases, and the previous discussion note was mainly based on the first case, which was CSR versus the Chief Commissioner of State Revenue in 2006, and it was in New South. This one and the second case, which we'll talk about, were both New South Wales. And it apportioned top-up contributions based on defined benefit liabilities. And our discussion note was provided in October 2009. And we believed at the time that it was reasonable to assume top-up contributions are those in excess of normal contributions determined by the actuary as appropriate. The discussion note states one method of apportioning top-up, so it wasn't necessarily, it's a discussion note, it's not a professional standard or even a guidance note, to do the apportionment, so there could be other methods used. And there have been, I suppose, unless the amounts are small, it'd be only used if it was material top-up contributions. We don't think many clients would pay for actuaries to do numbers where it wouldn't make a material difference to their payroll tax. And specifically now, obviously we're some 20 years post then, so it's only relating to defined benefit liabilities that are proportioned for that prior to payroll tax being introduced period. So remember that that's part of it as well. Now, there was a Qantas Airways case, which has actually then resulted in a tax ruling, and it has introduced some additional things to consider, and we will go through those today. And while actuaries have many different opinions, the ruling actually sets out an approach based on court decisions that could be reasonably relied upon. And we note, though, that it does not have the force of law. But it's a New South Wales Chief Commissioner did allow for it, and they can still choose not to accept an actuary's certificate in accordance with the ruling, maybe on the advice of another actuary. So we just note that. And an actuary could use an alternative method. So it could be rejected by the Commissioner, and then still the employer could continue to take it to the courts. So the hope of the ruling, I suppose, is that the Commissioner might limit the number of these that might eventually end up in court, but it may still result in them going to court. Some of the definitions we're talking about today include normal cost contribution, and this is determined at the start of the payroll tax year, and it's a contribution determined by an actuary that is expected to be sufficient to fund the benefits estimated to accrue to members over the following year, less the contributions paid payable by members. And the method that the Commissioner did accept in this particular case was the projected unit credit method. So the PUC method can be used irrespective of whether that is the funding method used. It may be become a default because it will often result in a lower normal cost contribution and potentially a higher payroll tax exemption than other funding methods, and indeed then we might be obliged to use it. Calculations do not need to be made by the actuary who is the funding actuary, so it could be another actuary, and in particular this is advice to the employer, not to a trustee. Obviously, we look at definitions of surplus and deficit, which is calculated based on accrued benefits at the start of the relevant year. There's a terminology within the ruling about adjusted normal cost contributions, and it is the normal cost that has been adjusted to take into account any available surplus or deficit required to fund the scheme or plan. The actuary may advise the period of time over which it is appropriate to either utilise any surplus or to fund any deficit. A surplus can be applied to reduce the employer contribution that would otherwise be required. If there is a deficit, additional employer contributions will be required. Now, we've put this in bold because it is important. If there is no recommendation by an actuary, the Chief Commissioner will accept 3 or more years as an appropriate period over which to utilise any surplus or to fund any deficit without the need for justification of the period chosen. The SPC actually was very clear when they were talking to the draft rule with regards to this draft ruling that they didn't want actuaries to be required to set the period. We don't feel that we are tax advisors or work for the tax office. And I suppose just our personal view would be you would try not to give advice, but if the Commissioner said 3 years, that doesn't seem too unreasonable to use 3 years, because the shorter the period, the better for the employer in this case, and we are generally advising the employer. So I'll keep moving on. The amortisation period does not have to be linked to funding. So it's not linked to funding in the ruling. So it can be something different to what you are doing on a funding basis. And employers may put pressure to use a 3-year amortisation period for funding if there was a link to minimise their payroll tax. We want obviously to be clear here that for this purpose, the employer may give you a direction as to what to use in your calculations for the certificate regarding payroll tax. But obviously we need to be very careful if we're working for the trustee with regard to being the funding actuary. And the trustee may have totally different requirements. And we also need to consider SPS 160, particularly in deficit situations where you might not be allowed to fund it over 3 years if it's a VB problem. So just take those all into account. So we just note that you'll have to take some care if you're doing this. We think 3 years is likely to be the norm, firstly because it was actually mentioned in the Qantas case and the 3-year period was mentioned, and secondly it is an intervaluation period, so it's used for many other things, so we think that's quite reasonable. But another period could be used and may need to be justified to the Commissioner. I mean, the ruling says 3 or more years. If you wanted to use something less than that, that's likely when you're going to have more questions from the Commissioner. And again, obviously, you're needing to look at materiality before you even begin most of this work, because we're talking about pro-rata-ing anything that's only more than 20 years ago in most cases. Okay, so some additional points to note. It's not just talking about deficit. So firstly, if in deficit, any contributions in excess of the normal cost contributions can be apportioned between exempt and liable contributions. So I think most of us would get our head around that. That's quite straightforward, and it's similar to what was in the CSR case. But it also covers surplus. If there's a surplus and any contributions are in excess of the adjusted normal cost, or the adjusted normal contributions, they can be apportioned between exempt and liable contributions as well. So I took a while to get my head around that one, so I'll leave that with you. And the method of apportioning contributions to, say, pre-July 96 is based on apportionment of accrued defined benefit liabilities at the start of that particular relevant financial year. And you can use assumptions that you have in PS 400 or update them if they need a change as appropriate. As I noted before, these two cases were both New South Wales based, and there would be, we have less clarity with regards to other states, but we would expect that similar and consistent approaches would likely be used as well. And that's all I have for you. So if you have any questions or you want to take it to both of us regarding the super reforms as well, we'll leave it to you now.
So it doesn't seem like there's any questions, but I would encourage you to think about them, and we're keen to get any feedback. You can email us with your questions. What email address did you say? How about mine? I don't think we've got a central email mailing address, so, or Ben's, or, but you, I'm sure you can work out an email address of someone on the SPC or you know one of us. So please, we would encourage you to send us any questions about any of the issues that we covered in the previous section, or the one that Saffron's just raised concerning payroll tax. So thanks for your attendance today, and you've got a little bit more left in your afternoon now. Thank you.